it on. Two-thirds a person. Rapings and beatings and suffering that worsens. Black human packages tied up in strings. Black rage can come from all these kinds of things.
I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Now we're about to have a conversation with Aura Bogota. She is the news editor for Color Lines and produced this piece, which I'm glad she did because I've been thinking a great deal about it, in terms of the rebellions that took place in the 60s and 64. Aura, welcome. Good to have you back here on the Mark Steiner Show.
It's great to be back, Mark. Thank you so much.
So this piece you wrote, remembering the seven quote-unquote race riots that happened exactly 50 years ago. I think that people forget the history and what led up to these things and how intense that time was.
Right. And I think that a lot of times when we think about quote-unquote race riots in the 1960s, we tend to think about the Watts riots, rather, in 1965. But what happened after those Watts riots was Governor Pat Brown in California put together a special commission to sort of, you know, inform him, like, what led up to this, what actually happened, how can we move forward? And the commission took a great deal of time to sort of look at what happened in the summer of 1964, right? So this is the summer before the Watts riots of 1965. And it was funny when I ran across it because, you know, if you take out some of the antiquated language, like it uses the word Negroes for black or Caucasians for white, right? It reads really familiar. They find that overall in these seven cities, right, they found that there were these underlying issues. One, there weren't enough jobs to go around. Two, there was schooling that was disadvantageous to black children. And three, and I want to quote, a resentment, even hatred of the police as a symbol of authority. And I just feel like this is, you know, this is like exactly what I'm reading right now in terms of the analysis and sort of what's fueling this. Yes, it definitely is about bringing justice for what happened to Michael Brown. But, you know, there are a lot of underlying issues, and it's just telling that it hasn't changed that much in some ways in 50 years.
So what do you think that tells us about then and now, about how these are connected? I mean, when you read the report, as you alluded to in the article you wrote, and I pulled the report up and I had not read it in years, that, A, to me, the language in that report was really objectifying when it came to the black community, looking at this is their problem, you know, that this is and this kind of looking at it that way really kind of was not shocking, but it was very telling. Some ways, you hear the same kind of similar language, though much more cleverly put in today's world.
Right, it's true. I mean, a couple of things came up for me. When I went to, I wasn't actually familiar with this commission's report. And so when I went back to look at, well, you know, who authored it, who was on the commission, so Warren Christopher actually vice-chaired the commission. So this is, you know, a lot of folks are probably familiar with the Christopher Commission, that came out of the 1991 rebellion in Los Angeles. And
right.
So, you know, he chairs this commission in 1964. He has his own commission in 1991, so that's 27, you know, almost 30 years apart, right? And it's interesting because the commission sort of conclude very similar things 27 years apart. And I'm sure that whatever commission comes out of what's happening in Ferguson is going to also conclude, you know, a disparity in education, a disparity in the availability of jobs, and, you know, this hatred for the police, right? But I will say that the conclusions and the recommendations that they have do tend to, and I totally agree that there's a lot of objectification on the black community, but they do make these recommendations that are like, we have to put a deep emphasis on, like, how we deal with this and, you know, provide certain programs to alleviate unemployment and poverty, et cetera. So, you know, and I've heard a lot that people are like, well, what really is wrong? And I kind of feel like we've known for at least 50 years this commission looks like something that I could very well be authored in 2014. yes, some of the language reads kind of funny, but it's the same thing. There are the same underlying issues. The Black community is still being objectified, but at the end of the day, these commissions even now, like, well, we need to get these programs in place to change things. The sad thing is you have the Christopher Commission in 64, or you have this original commission in 64, Christopher Commission in 91, whatever's going to come out of this today. And it's sad that the focus continues to be on, like, what is wrong with Black people, right? Because I think we've seen a lot of that, right?
And, right.
Instead of, like, well, what conditions can be changed to make this different, right? And the thing is that it's not like there aren't answers. It's not like this hasn't been considered for at least 50 years, right? I didn't go back and even look at, like, earlier, quote-unquote, race rebellions. I just found it fascinating that exactly 50 years ago we had them. In seven cities, too.
In the same cities. And interesting enough, one of the things that hit me in the pieces you wrote and then looking at those reports was the reports were talking about the isolation of these new residents of the inner city coming in with no jobs and being separated and separate from the rest of society. And what was glaring to me about that is what popped out to me was that if that was the beginning, which it was of some of the migration into places like in some of these center cities, the isolation has only grown deeper in 50 years, not gotten better.
And yes,
the school systems have gotten more deeply segregated and they've gotten worse in many ways and much more oppressive and all that kind of stuff. The housing, I mean, if you walked into those cities in 1964, which I did in some of those cities, you saw neighborhoods that were full of people and houses, dislocated or not. Now you walk into those cities, and they're like war zones. They're dead zones. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I mean, to me, it's even gotten worse than it was in 64 on some levels.
Yeah, it's something that struck me, too. And again, as someone who largely grew up in L.A., you know, I always knew as a kid, like, there had been these Watts riots, right?
Right.
It was very far, far removed from the time when I was growing up, right? But what was interesting to me is, you know, reading this report and reading about the summer of 1964, it starts out here in New York City where I live now. Essentially, you have this white off-duty police officer named Thomas Milligan who shoots and kills a 15-year-old named James Powell.
Right.
Supposedly, Powell had a knife, but it never, like, there was never any conclusion. Milligan was found not guilty of all charges. Powell was left to bleed out on the floor, like no ambulance was ever called, which, you know, sounds really familiar to the Michael Brown case. So that starts in November. I'm sorry, in New York City in the sort of middle of July. It then spreads over to Rochester, then to Jersey City, then to Patterson, then to Elizabeth, then to Chicago, and then to Philadelphia, right? Which I just found fascinating. Like, how is it that, like, I had never heard of these, you know, seven events that were all triggered by one original event that happened here in Harlem, right? It does make me think, too, because I know that there's a lot of agitation over what happened with Azelle Ford's killing in Los Angeles, which is another Black man, unarmed Black man who was killed by police officers there. And I know, you know, I sort of feel like at any time people are very upset, of course, about this level of police brutality to the point where people are, you know, Black men in particular are targeted and killed by police officers. But you're right. I mean, I haven't been to sort of these big cities and seen Black neighborhoods in which people live in houses. I mean, it is sort of that very deep segregated divide. I think it's an ongoing process. I know, like, another issue here in New York is gentrification. You know, like, I have not lived here. I think I've lived here about 3 years. And, you know, for my Black friends that live in Crown Heights, whom I visit a lot, I'm just seeing their neighborhood just change. Like, wow, there's, you know, $8 kale chips being sold here now, you know?
Right, right.
And there is, like, I don't work on housing at all. I can think of some ways to sort of mitigate that, but I just don't see that actively happening here. And, you know, again, it's a lot of the same issues, and it's in a lot of the same cities. I've never even heard of Ferguson. I had to look up Missouri and make sure that I knew where it was on the map. I was more or less right. But it's, you know, in some ways I made the decision not to go to Ferguson. I may change my mind eventually, but I feel like, you know, there's so many great people there on the ground already. But I sort of feel like, in a way, I could just take a map and just point to a place and find the closest sort of segregated town, segregated city, which there always is nearby, and kind of look at what's happening there, you know? Look at the schools, look at what kind of funding they have. It's a place like New Orleans, they're the only kind of public education that there is charter schools, for example. Like, what does that do to the community there? You know, look at housing, look at police brutality. We know now that this incident in Ferguson isn't isolated. And we know that there, you know, in the county of St. Louis itself, I mean, Black folks do not trust, you know, the administration that's in charge there, and there are very good reasons for that. And so while it very much is about Michael Brown and Darren Wilson and Ferguson, I think it's just really about the United States of America and any Black community you could put your finger on.
And I, you know, one of the things you pointed out in this piece, which was important in 64 when these rebellions took place, and people call them race riots, and I prefer to use the term rebellion given the what motivated people to stand up and fight after this murder of this young boy. But it, as you said, it went from New York City to Rochester to Jersey City to Paterson, New Jersey to Elizabeth and into Philadelphia. And people angry over the same thing emanating out of Harlem, out of New York. And here in this moment, you're seeing maybe not riots and rebellions happening in other cities in solidarity with Ferguson, but you're seeing people doing what people in Ferguson are doing, having rallies, walking, going across Baltimore, in L.A., and all across America. People are standing up with Ferguson, which I find really interesting, and you're seeing, well, let me just stop there. I mean, I think that's a difference about the two times, two eras, I should say.
It's absolutely fascinating. And, you know, there's many ways to look at it. One way that I think about it is also that, you know, we keep hearing, there's so many characters out of Ferguson, it's hard to remember which one said the racist thing. But I think it may have been Ferguson's police chief who said there were, quote-unquote, outside agitators coming in, which is like, okay, someone's never read Martin Luther King. but, you know, it was also interesting to me to see that framing, like, people from the outside are coming in, and I'm like, first of all, I don't think that's a bad thing at all. I mean, people in Ferguson are asking for that. They're asking for that kind of solidarity. They're asking for activists to come. They're asking for nurses. They want certain supplies. You know, there's a need for more bodies on the ground there. And aside from that, I think that a lot of the anger that we're seeing in Ferguson from people who live in other cities is justified in those cities. And so I think there almost could be an argument made for, well, let's this place take the brunt of it right now, because I feel like we're a moment away from it just spreading to six other cities like it did in 1964. And
right.
People are very justifiably angry, you know? And at the same time, I do think it's amazing the way people have organized online. I mean, I just started following so many new people on Twitter that I'm like, wow, people are from Ferguson or from other places and are there or are talking about it. So even like in a digital community, that's been fascinating to me. The folks that have been organizing, particularly Feminisa Jones, who organized, I think it was like 115 rallies, you know, last Thursday all over the United States. And people came out, you know, people just
right.
like, came out everywhere. And it's fascinating to see like how dedicated and what sense of solidarity people feel throughout the United States for this town. And again, I think that it's also for the experiences that they have themselves or that their family members have or that their friends have, or ultimately like for their sense of justice as well, you know? And that has been fascinating to see.
And I think that one of the things you mentioned here, and I think is also critical to this is, you know, the real news about what's happening inside of Ferguson is coming through Twitter, is coming through the communications of people themselves in Ferguson, but also with people around the country tweeting back and forth with the folks in Ferguson, sharing pictures and ideas and comments. That's where the real news is happening in real time with people all across the country.
I mean, that alone has been fascinating. So, like I said, I decided not to go to Ferguson. One of the reasons why is because I just take in a lot of social media. I love being on Twitter. I love Instagram. Not so much Facebook, but I get information from Facebook, you know. And then I'm, you know, actually am a reporter myself. And, you know, I'm like glued to the wire and into breaking news and stuff. But what's been amazing is to see, like, how Twitter in particular, right? Like, people, it's just this constant flow of information. And that's what was, for me as a journalist, as someone who I see for this particular story up until now, I'm just trying to sort of aggregate some of what's happening. It's impossible to gather everything. But, you know, instead of spending sort of all day and night in Ferguson trying to get one story, I've just been trying to, like, sort of aggregate different things, you know,
right.
Find this 1965 report, you know, sort of tie in different pieces. I think my time is sort of better served like that. But that's what was so kind of daunting to me about the curfew. I mean, aside from the fact that they were limiting the right to free assembly, for me, the sort of selfish part of me was like, well, when am I going to look at it 1 a.m? Like, you know, like, because I'm up really early in the morning and I'm up really late at night, you know, and
right.
I'm on Twitter. Yes, I'm turning on, like, cable news and, you know, somebody might send me a text if they happen to be there. But really, really, I'm on Twitter. And it was sad to see, like, how much that fell off because a lot of people, you know, felt like legally they had to oblige to the curfew. The curfew was also coupled with what authorities are calling the quote-unquote media staging area. And so you had a lot of journalists who I respect in general, but I didn't understand their decision to abide by the quote-unquote staging area because it made it impossible for them to actually do their job. And so, for example, they were stuck in this, the staging area is basically a parking lot, and they were told they couldn't leave. And then they saw what looked like tear gas in, you know, several blocks away. And the public information officer for the police was telling them, no, that's just smoke. We're not using tear gas.
Yeah, right.
And so for an entire night, you know, journalists, CNN in particular, everyone was saying, no, it's just smoke. It's just smoke. It's just smoke. And it's like, well, no, it actually was tear gas, you know, and they admitted it the next day. But that's really dangerous. That's really dangerous in terms of, like, the way that we think about freedom of the press. I think it sets a really dangerous precedent, too, to say you can only stay in this area. We're going to tell you what happened. And then that those folks went and reported it in that way. And so I think that was a combination of, one, a lot of people not being on Twitter because there was this curfew, and two, for the people who decided they were going to go out despite the curfew, the reporters couldn't actually get nearby and see. I think for any of us who've been close to tear gas, like, you know you're close to tear gas.
Right. Yes,
you know?
yes.
There's no, like, maybe it was or maybe it was, like, you sort of know right away, right?
Right, so, exactly.
But being removed from it and then being told, no, that's only smoke, like, you can't tell. You know, I couldn't tell from far away. I don't know that anybody could. But that sort of is what's really scary to me. And I think that kind of, like, staging area and then the combination with the curfew, I think that has a lot to do with the way that people are using social media, right? Like, these community journalists that are like, I'm going to tell this story, right? And it's been fascinating, but also the response for me, and I think I'll probably feel this for a long time, it's scary. It's scary that the press and the community journalists can just sort of be shut down like that.
Now, it is very frightening. I mean, clearly this is that the police are targeting the press in a very serious way, even the establishment press. You know, and I think that's a very frightening aspect to this.
I think I want to add to that. I just posted something about a German war correspondent who it's really clear that he, you know, isn't doing anything wrong, just like most of the people that have been arrested, the vast majority. And he's arrested, you know, he asked the cop, like, well, what's your name? And the guy's like, my name is Donald Duck. You know, he gets taken in with his, you know, his friend, these two war correspondents. And he has this paragraph where he's like, I've been in Iraq, I've been in Vietnam, I've been in China, I've spoken with Cubans. Like, he just sort of lists all of these things, and he's like, but nothing, like, basically prepared me for Ferguson and the kind of repression that I faced as a journalist there.
That's pretty amazing.
And, like, that's not going to go away, you know? Like, Egypt is calling for the United States to have restraint in Ferguson, you know? It's not like... I know that we see this as like a Ferguson story, a police brutality story, a race story, a United States story, but it's a war story around the world. You know, as someone who's from Latin America, I mean, my family has, they don't have necessarily a good sense of like what's where. And they're like, are you near any of that stuff? You know, because they know.
Right.
They're like, are you okay? Are you okay? They're shooting people. It looks like a war. It is a war. And I mean, that's how the rest of the world sees it. You know, and that's how war correspondents, I mean, the fact alone that media outlets are sending war correspondents, right, in particular, really says a lot about this moment. And going back to 1964, you know, if we paid attention to some of those recommendations, even today, 50 years later, I think it would do a lot to stop this from happening again. And if we don't, it will happen again.
It will happen again. And I think that one of the things you're seeing in this, and before you have to run, is just the idea that you can see bubbling out of this in ways you didn't see in 64 because it was a different time and different stuff was going on and people were not paying attention to the urban world at all at that moment because in the midst of the civil rights movement and everything else that was happening, that what you're seeing now come out of places like Ferguson, this is part of a... in all the tragedy, within the tragedy, you're seeing the building of a national movement that is rising from the bottom up and connected in ways that we've never seen before, I think.
It's true. It's true. And I'll reserve my opinion about certain, you know, leaders. but I think what's fascinating is this, and I've read it several times where they're like, there is no leader. Where's the leader? There is a generational divide. And, you know, and it's like, I read a quote, I think it was in the New York Times, where someone said, Michael Brown is our leader. And I was like, that's right. That's the best motivation you can have, you know. So it is fascinating. It's a good time. The response is pretty fascinating.
Well, I deeply appreciate the analysis and passion you bring to your writing and what you bring to us on Color Lines. And always a pleasure to have Aura Bogado with us here on The Mark Steiner Show, news editor for Color Lines. Aura, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mark. Take care.
Take care, you too. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.